Welcome back to the Athenaeum Review. I'm here with Martin Powers, the author of China and England, the pre-industrial struggle for justice in word and image. In your study, you show that an English translation of Confucian writings done in 1691 had a powerful effect on English-speaking philosophers throughout the Enlightenment, down to Thomas Paine and Thomas Jefferson. Can you talk a little bit about where this translation came from and why it was so important in the West?
Yeah, actually, there were several translations. That was the among the earlier ones, that was very important. And then there's another one in 1736 and 38, came out in two editions, and had several editions thereafter, which was also very important. Yeah. So this first one is really, actually, it first came out in Latin, and it a few years earlier. Yeah. Of course, not everyone could read Latin. The Latin was actually translations from portions of Confucius, Analects, and the Great Learning and other major Confucian texts. But it was the Morals of Confucius in English, which probably had the greater impact because more people could read that. And those are more redactions, but they're pretty accurate. So when I read through it, for example, I can recognize, oh, this is from the Analects, this is from Mencius, this is from the Great Learning. There's even a little bit from Zhuxi in there. Yeah. And in the context of that period, this was radical stuff.
Yeah.
Confucius, you know, again, he says a person's social status is irrelevant.
Yeah.
If they have good advice for government, they have good advice for government.
Yeah.
If they will, if they can make a good official, then he can be a good official, and so on. And also the notion that there should be feedback from the people. These were all incredibly radical ideas in the 1680s and 90s. But one of the most important notions that comes through there is the idea that the purpose of government is to promote the happiness of the people. And that's a leitmotif that appears several times.
Yeah.
That shows up again in Lecomte's book on China, which was also very popular. And again, a leitmotif is this notion of government promoting the happiness of the people.
Yeah.
Lecomte's text was so offensive to the French nobility that the book was burned. Because they didn't like these kinds of ideas at all, much less Lecomte talks about meritocracy and again, how officials are appointed based on their learning and ability. It has nothing to do with class and so on. The French didn't like that, so they burned it. But the book was very widely read in England. And then even bigger impact was in the 1730s when J.B. Duhalde published two big tomes about China. There was a lot of discursive information about Chinese customs, but the most important parts were actual translations. Now, these translations were made by Jesuits. Some of them had already been made in the late 17th century, and others in the 18th century. And he translated many things, many primary documents, but the most important was a collection that the Chinese themselves had made of, it's like the Chinese great books. It was the most exemplary essays by the greatest statesmen throughout history. And these were first compiled in Song times by private historians. And they were widely read in Song times as a kind of a crib studying for the exam. So it would be as if you were reading the great books to prepare for the exam. And then Kangxi in the 17th century ordered all these various collections put together into a single book, and that's what the Jesuits translated. The Jesuits figured, oh, this would be useful because this is the best political thinking coming out of China. And so that got translated. Samuel Johnson read this and said, like, wow. And he wrote a glowing book review. And Samuel Johnson was the most respected writer in England in the 18th century. You probably know that. So Samuel Johnson says you should read this book. I know a lot of people read it. Horace Walpole, for example, for his 17th birthday, got a copy of it. So this was widely read, and immediately the radical English intellectuals, at that time they were called the free thinkers, started quoting liberally from these texts in order to argue against aristocracy and for meritocracy. Now, this whole chapter, as far as I can tell, has been left out of Western books on England. It's really strange. You know, when we talk about the Enlightenment, we pick up with Rousseau. That's already decades later. Or Montesquieu. We start with Montesquieu.
Yeah.
Montesquieu actually was responding to this because these guys were saying, hey, you know, in China, anybody can be an official.
Yeah.
Montesquieu was a baron. He didn't like this idea at all.
Yes.
So he argues against it several times. And he says, no, absolutely not. Commoners cannot actually have office. He says we should follow the Romans, who were, and that was an aristocracy,
right,
or the English, another aristocracy,
right,
you know, where people are allowed to vote, but by God, don't let them actually have power.
Yeah.
And so Montesquieu argues vigorously against this, but these documents were very important, and you can see echoes of them in Jefferson, and most of Tom Paine's major points are in there. And you won't find them in English writings
for
that period.
Wow.
So, my chapters in this book trace this almost decade by decade.
Amazing. These ideas that you've been discussing, as you pointed out, they're perennial, and they seem so so full of implication and significance. You know, for us today, I wanted to ask you some questions, kind of about how these ideas play out. So, for example, you've discussed the choice that the state faces between treating people as individuals or as members of a group, and I thought, well, this would apply in thinking about ethnic groups as well and ethnic minorities. And I wondered if, you know, was the Chinese Empire ruling over different ethnic minority groups and thinking about this as well? Did that come into play?
Yeah, that's good. And thank you for bringing that up. Let me make it clear, the point of this book is not to say the Chinese did it first. And
right.
Actually, the word influence never appears in the book.
Okay. Oh, yes. Yes.
I don't see this as a question of influence.
Right.
It's true that English radicals made use of some of these Chinese texts, but I argue the reason they did this is because they were facing the same problems that these guys were facing. So these Chinese statesmen were arguing against privilege. They were arguing against corruption. They were arguing for a more egalitarian meritocratic system, and that's what the English were doing. So naturally, they looked at these texts and they said, "Yeah, you know, that makes sense. You know, we're doing this too." But in terms of your other question, the question you just asked, about ethnic, definitely ethnic is part of it. And there's actually a policy document from the 2nd century BCE that takes on this issue. You know, should we allow non-Chinese to be statesmen? And it argues absolutely on meritocratic grounds.
Wow.
He says it doesn't matter if they grew up in another country or whatever, this should be allowed. And that was incorporated into the exemplary, into the great books.
Yeah.
That particular essay was incorporated into this collection.
Yeah.
And there are many others that are completely egalitarian. They say you should have nothing to do with income or class. So again, when you get to the Tang, I think in the Tang, even in Tang times, which is not particularly meritocratic, but like 1 in 12 chancellors were non-Chinese.
Wow.
And when you get to the Song, Khitans, Muslims, all took the exam, the civil service exam. They didn't know if they were Khitan or Muslim because it was anonymous.
Right.
As I mentioned last night, the names were covered. Replaced with a number, and then the whole exam was copied with only the number on it.
Yeah.
So the examiners didn't know who had done it, and they couldn't even tell from the calligraphy. You know, you could, in theory, tell from the calligraphy if someone was high class or not.
Right.
But they couldn't because the scribes had copied these things.
Yeah.
So all the way through. I mean, even the Jesuits, I think, were given some official positions.
Another aspect of this I was curious about, this history that you describe of the development of ideas of individualism and meritocracy and so forth. In China today, with the Chinese government or Chinese intellectuals, is this sort of a well-known history that's referred to in terms of how to justify the government today and the system as legitimate? Is it well known?
My sense is that it's not. In fact, their notion of Chinese history comes from the West. Basically, the missionaries told them. The missionaries told them China's always been backward. Wow. China's always been autocratic. You know, and
that's ironic.
Yeah, and that's what they learn in their textbooks.
Amazing.
I know this because I teach in China fairly frequently.
Right.
I think the reason is that the Communist Party thought this would help them. If they could convince the population that everything before communism was garbage, then people would embrace communism. I think it backfired. I think or it could backfire. I don't think it's personally that it's a very wise policy for them. But I'm not an expert in modern China, so you know I don't know. But I think it's fair to say that they don't know much about this. I've published some things in Chinese. I wrote the essays in Chinese and published them. And some people have read those, and so some people pick up a bit of this from that. But in general, most Chinese in government have no idea of what a rich heritage they have.
I was also thinking about meritocracy and in the context of the United States and so forth, and how this idea of selection by talent and so forth. And I was thinking about examples. Let's say I picture someone, let's say in Silicon Valley, who's you know super brilliant and becomes very successful and very wealthy through their own efforts and brilliance and so forth. And then I think sometimes there's this phenomenon today where such people can sometimes become a little bit alienated from, let's say, ordinary people, maybe even kind of contemptuous of the people who seem less brilliant or backwards or unenlightened. And so I was curious about, within this history of meritocracy, are there examples of brilliant scholars who become frustrated with ordinary people and wish they were more enlightened or something?
Yeah, that's a great question, and there's two aspects to it. One is that nowadays I think meritocracy is very much misunderstood, at least in the blogs that I've read or the op-eds that I've read. People often confuse meritocracy with wealth. It's exactly the opposite.
Right.
The Chinese specifically excluded wealth, and so did Jefferson,
and
so did Paine. Wealth should not be considered a form of merit.
Right.
And the reason is, it's that term Zaide I mentioned last night.
Yeah.
That's the term for merit. It's got two parts to it.
Yeah.
One part is learning and ability, and the other part is public service.
Yeah.
Without public service, there is no merit.
Yeah.
So making yourself rich is not meritocratic.
Yes.
There's no merit to that. You're only serving yourself. You're not serving anyone else.
Yes.
So someone who does that is actually not qualified for office.
And
Jefferson makes this very clear. His assumption is that only qualified people will even be candidates. And this is why he thought you could leave it up to the people. Which gets to the other part of your question. Yes. For example, Dolbach, Diderot, were very depressed about the fact that they're trying to save these people, illiterate farmers. And the illiterate farmers adore the aristocracy. They see these fancy clothes, and you know they see he's wearing a golden belt or whatever. And they say, wow, this guy is cool. You know? And Diderot goes, oh, no. And Jefferson worried over this too, and so did the Chinese. You know, in my book I mentioned this. Lu You was a brilliant poet and statesman and a real liberal, social liberal, in the 12th century. And he has some poems where he just shakes his head and he says, you know, he's just poor fools, befuddled, and bemused. You know, they see their neighbors beaten.
Yeah.
By the tax collector, and they think it's only right, you know. And of course, this is a tendency, right? The conservative rural poor have a tendency to think the government is always right, right?
Yeah.
So if someone you know is somehow abused by the police, well, the police are right, you know. And it was the same in China.
Yeah.
And Lu You is just shaking his head and he's thinking, oh my God. So you have but that's a little different from the Silicon Valley case you mentioned. That one. Actually, I think Imperial China guarded against that because the assumption was that if you're in business, you should not be in government. There's a conflict of interest there. There's an automatic conflict of interest.
Wow.
And they didn't feel that you needed to prove that someone had actually done something wrong. That's, you know, we put the bar way high.
Right, right, right.
So unless someone actually sees you taking money out of the kitty,
right.
then you're okay. No, that's not, their standard was more like that that's applied to professors, as you know. So for example, I'm pretty sure at Michigan, I cannot have my son take a class from me. They don't feel they have to prove that I will favor my son.
Right,
I'm in a situation where the temptation, I could easily fool myself into thinking I was being objective when I wasn't. It wouldn't be fair to the other student. And in fact, I just took a test. We have to do this every few years. Yeah. All professors have to take a test to show that we understand conflict of interest. Apparently, presidents don't have to do that. But in China, that standard was applied to all officials. So if you were in a situation where you could make money off of your official position, i.e. you were a merchant, you weren't supposed to be an official.
Yeah. This is the Athenaeum Review. Our guest today is Martin Powers, the author of China and England, The Pre-Industrial Struggle for Justice in Word and Image. His visit to UT Dallas was made possible by the Confucius Institute at UTD. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
The Athenaeum Review is produced by Creative Disturbance and the UTD School of Arts and Humanities. Find out more at creativedisturbance.org.